Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. This week's podcast is from my August 6th hosting of Jackie Tucker's Stepping Out Show on KSCO 1080 AM in Santa Cruz, California. I'll be hosting her show on the first Saturday of every month at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. This is great because it gives you the opportunity to call in live at 831-479-1080 with your questions. And you can always email me at askdrdawn.com. We thank Jackie for helping keep Dr. Dawn on the air. Listen again on Saturday, September 3rd on KSCO 1080 on your AM dial or at KSCO.com for the live streaming show at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'd start out with a story that comes out of the University of Sydney. It spawned a lot of products, but I thought it'd be fun to go back to the original work. And this came out in October of 2015. And researchers looked at over 200,000 Australians looking at physical activity and just kind of doing the math. Who died early, what was going on with them. And what they found was that people who exercised at least 1 hour of moderate activity, and they defined that as walking, reduced their chance of early death by a whopping 12 to 14%. Now, that's a really, really substantial amount, and I thought it was pretty interesting to me to think about, just an hour of walking. An hour of walking works out to about 7,000 steps for those of you who have Fitbits or other activity monitors. And if you think about taking a walk at lunch, maybe parking on the far side of the parking lot, maybe taking a walk before you brave that commute home, it may not be so hard to get that hour a day of walking. The average person does 2 to 3 hours of TV a day, so there's plenty of time to get up and walk around. Researchers also found that if you replace 1 hour of sitting with sleeping, assuming you aren't getting enough sleep, that is to say less than 7 hours. So if you can get your sleep up to 7 hours, on the average, there's a 6% decrease in premature death. So as a society, what we need to be doing is some local political action, actually, in my opinion. We need to make our cities and towns more walk-friendly. We need an infrastructure with more cycleways, more parks, more public transport. I certainly would love to see a railway line coming from South County to North County so that people could walk from a railway stop conveniently getting to their work. In Europe, where that is the setup, people do a lot better. But out here, we're so distributed, we've really forgotten how to walk. And boy, is that the exercise that we're evolved for. I want to point out that you can email me by going to askdrdawn.com, and there's an email site there. And you can also listen to old programs and archived interviews on the program, and very shortly we'll be adding some blogs, but those aren't up there yet, so don't go hunting for them at the moment. But we're working on it. Now, our next story solves a controversy. This is from just last month, and it comes out from Columbia University Medical Center. We're talking about wheat sensitivity. Now, there's a lot of people out there who think that wheat sensitivity is a whole bunch of just plain hokum, that this is placebo, and I'm here to tell you that I really want to say, in my medical opinion, it's real. Now, there are two types of wheat sensitivity. One of them is an autoimmune disease called celiac disease, and this is where the immune system attacks the lining of the small intestine. It's a very dangerous and severe thing. By attacking the lining of the small intestine, you lose those villi. So the normal small intestine's like a deep pile shag carpet with big, thick protrusions, and that drastically increases the surface area, such that it's about a doubles tennis court. Think about that. Your small intestine has a doubles tennis court worth worth of surface area with which to absorb vitamins, nutrients, glucose, all those things that we put in your mouth and need to somehow get into the bloodstream. But when you have celiac disease, that autoimmune attack stunts the villi, they scar up, and instead of having a tennis court, you might have, well, the surface area, say, of a hallway runner, not nearly enough to absorb your nutrients, and people with celiac disease can actually die, they can become severely malnourished and actually require IV nutrition to survive. That's not the kind of food sensitivity we're talking about right now. This other wheat sensitivity is much more subtle. It's called non-celiac wheat sensitivity. And researchers at Columbia have finally validated and reported in one of the top GI journals, Gut, in July, that this is, in fact, a real thing. Now, the natural medicine folks, the naturopaths, and the functional medicine folks, we've been saying this for years and treating it successfully, I might add. But for a place like Columbia to actually acknowledge it is a real big deal. The study that they used to validate a concept that, like I said, many of us have been acting on in a long time was to test 80 individuals with celiac disease and another group who was a control group. And what they did was they fed them large amounts of wheat and they watched what happens. The control group did develop some wheat sensitivity, but they did not develop the T cells that are part of celiac disease. They did not develop autoimmune disease. What they did develop was an activation of the immune system that led to an increase, well, a leak, if you will. And what happened with that leak, think about the cells being stuck together with Velcro. If the Velcro gets loose, then little particles can get by. And the particles that got through were toxins from bacteria. So the cell walls of bacteria were able to squeeze through these damaged cell-to-cell barriers. And these bacterial toxins, which activate something in our immune system called toll-like receptors, part of our rapid response against bacteria, led to increased inflammation. And that inflammation led to increased leakage and increased passage of more particles, larger particles, across that barrier. These larger particles include food particles. So the food particles of wheat are particularly able to generate an immune response. And so if they leak across, they act just as strongly as these bacterial toxins in their ability to generate an immune response. So extremely interesting stuff. And what does it mean for you? Well, for one thing, there's a couple of products out there that can drastically worsen this permeability issue. And one of them is ibuprofen, also naproxen, and other drugs that we use for pain control. So one bit of advice is if you start to have a lot of upset stomach, maybe diarrhea after eating certain foods, more stomach cramping, it may be because you're on this path. And so reducing or eliminating your use of nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories for a while and moving to more natural agents like curcumin and turmeric and high-dose fish oil are really good ways to control aches and pains in the joint without affecting your gut permeability. So we really need to protect ourselves against leaky gut because there's lots of things besides wheat in our diet that can contribute to that. So going on a different set of anti-inflammatories that are easier on the gut, making sure that if you do use anti-inflammatories, you do it with food, which helps protect the gut lining, can make a very, very big difference in your long-term gut health. Let's go to some email. One of the wonderful things that is in my life is that I get email, because of my radio programs, from all over the country, and sometimes all over the world. This first email comes from Silas in Accra, Ghana. This is relating to an abnormal skin condition. I'm 31 years old now, but I and my brother Caleb have been suffering, have been suffering from an abnormal condition. Our bodies would be itching us just after bathing. Sometimes it takes 25 to 30 minutes before the itching will stop. I first experienced it when I was 12. We'd visited numerous hospitals and specialized clinics, but to no avail. We desperately need your help. I was thrilled when I watched from Ghana how you and your team are helping others on embarrassing body problems, and I realized you could help me and my brother. We need your help, please. So, Silas, first of all, let me just tell you, you're my first email from Ghana, although not my first from Africa. So I want to shout out here from Santa Cruz, California, and say hi. Silas obviously will be picking up his answer on the podcast, which you can subscribe to at AskDrDon.com, and I encourage all of you to do that because there's different material beyond what comes out over this station, and I think you'll enjoy it. What Silas is experiencing is histamine release in the skin. And the skin is full of cells called mast cells, which are there to protect us, but which can release histamine when they're traumatized or triggered. And usually a primed cell like this, a primed mast cell, is primed because this individual has a type of IgE-mediated allergy. Now, that can be pollen, it can be mold, it can be dust mites, and IgG allergies, the food sensitivities, are different. IgE, E as in Edward, are the kinds that make you sneeze. Many people with asthma will have high levels of IgE and thus high levels of histamine in their system. And when it comes to the nose and the throat, it responds pretty well to antihistamines, but the skin is different. So the first thing that I have people do when they complain of this itching after bathing, usually if it's lasting 25 to 30 minutes, it's not just dry skin, but one of the things that you can try is lotions and lubricants. I expect that Silas has already been there and done that. And the next thing is to take two kinds of commonly available antihistamines. One is an H1 blocker. The classic one for this is diphenhydramine or Benadryl. And the other one is cimetidine. The classic one of this is Tagamet. And in the United States, at least, both of these are available without a prescription. I can't speak for Ghana, but they are widely available drugs. And in the era of the internet, these are quite inexpensive, and I'm pretty sure you can get a hold of them. And the idea would be to take about 25 milligrams of the diphenhydramine and around 200 milligrams of the cimetidine twice a day. And you just do that every day for about a week and continue with your bathing as normal and see whether or not your itching drops. And if your itching gets much better, well, for one thing, woohoo, we've at least solved the problem for the short run. And then you begin to think, well, could I possibly figure out what I'm allergic to and avoid it? And that is quite a can of worms to figure out. Allergy testing, which is a blood test, can be helpful in some cases, but it's not always possible to avoid breathing. And if it's a pollen or dust mite antigens that are causing that you're swallowing, essentially, and they're going into your stomach, and these antigens are actually going through a disturbed gut, leaky gut, and triggering the immune system and activating the mast cells, you may be caught in a loop that you will not be able to stop. So I hope that you'll be able to try the diphenhydramine and the cimetidine, and we'll put the spelling of those up in the keyword section on the website where this email is discussed. Our next email is from Switzerland, and this from Sybil. Sybil is asking a question about sunblock out there in Switzerland. She's probably fair skin, doesn't want to get a burn. A while ago, I asked you if the sunblock with zinc oxide and titanium oxide is safe. You answered the question about zinc oxide, but what about the titanium? Most sun screens that are mineral-based contain both of these ingredients. So, Sibel, I'm going to cut short the rest of your question because it's essentially asking the same question and say that, yes, in my opinion, titanium oxide and zinc oxide, when they are micronized so they aren't so terribly shiny, are still very effective and very safe. It's been tested. Researchers have actually done punch biopsies of the skin, and all of those particles, those nanoparticles, are getting trapped at the superficial layer of the skin. You can see where they all get hung up right at the basal cell layer, which is a very tight junction that's designed to keep things from passing. And because these are metals, they have a charge, and things with a charge don't penetrate that basal layer of the skin very much at all. In fact, we have to doctor chemicals quite thoroughly, make them what we call lipid soluble, get rid of all of their polar or charged qualities in order to get them to penetrate. And so you'll see that not many medications are available. We're going to try switching to a caller. This is Erica in Aptos. Hello, Erica.
Hello, Dr. Dawn.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I have kind of a general question about nightmares and what's going on when we have nightmares.
Okay, that's a really, really interesting question. So nightmares are a dream, obviously, and there are several different kinds. Very small children who have an undeveloped or not fully developed nervous system will have what's called night terrors, and this usually will occur between the ages of about 2 and 5, and they will wake up just screaming and in an extreme case of sympathetic upset, and they won't be able to speak or articulate it, and they have no memory of the dream. And somewhere along the age of 5, those go away in most individuals. And, of course, children still have nightmares. I still remember a few doozies I had when I was in grade school. And we think that this is because the central nervous system, and particularly the memory system, the hippocampus, and the emotional part of the system, which is right next door, get a little bit of crosstalk going on and get into an amplification loop. So you can think about sort of a short circuit happening in a nightmare where the dream and the emotions that are generated by the dream start to amplify each other. And so you get into a place where fear and a lot of adrenaline start to be released, which is not typical for most dreams. At that point, the brain will actually start inventing a dream that explains the adrenaline. And so you can get into a loop. A lot of times, a severe nightmare will develop an imprint. And so let's talk about some of the factors that contribute to getting this short circuit as an adult. Because in children, they don't have a mature nervous system, so they have a hard time damping things down. In adults with a mature nervous system, it tends to be things that cause our nervous system to be more irritable. So, for example, caffeine, sleep deprivation, and stress, kind of the recipe for modern society, if you will. And so if a person is caffeinated or sleep deprived and they have this central nervous system irritability going on, they can kick into a nightmare. And some individuals have more problems with these than others. I had one patient once who had daymares where she would, you know, like we would, like you and I would have a daydream and start thinking about dinner or start thinking about, oh, I really like that. I mean, I'm a clothes freak, so for me, it's, oh, I really like that dress that I saw, and I'm sorry I didn't buy it. And in those runaway kind of thoughts in her daymares, she would start seeing dismembered people and, you know, scenes out of some kind of battlefield and just horrific stuff that would just intrude on her consciousness. And we were able to treat her with a combination of acupuncture and hypnosis. And because when she came to me, she was on very high doses of sleep agents, and they weren't working anymore. She was having nightmares through, like, I think she was on something like 20 milligrams of Ambien, and she was still having nightmares, and that's an overdose. So what we ended up doing with her was stepping her gradually down, supporting her with acupuncture and hypnosis. And we were able to eradicate the daymares completely and get her down to, I think she still takes about 5 milligrams of Ambien a night, and she's just fine. She's totally back to normal. So a single nightmare, you know, basically get up, go drink some water, take a walk, do some displacement activity, and then lie back in bed, and you'll usually be able to fall back asleep and not have another nightmare. But when people get into a situation where they're looping, that's when you need to think about maybe some alternative therapy. Don't just go to the doctor and get a sleeping pill, because those things over time feed into the problem.
Mm-hmm. What's a displacement activity? Just getting out of the bedroom?
Taking your mind off it. So are you going outside, looking at the moon, taking some deep breaths? If it's cold, maybe going into your bathroom and taking a hot shower or hot bath, but something that's just a different activity. Now, if you wake up and you're not like super hyped up and your heart's not beating and it's just, oh, I had a bad dream, and you feel sleepy, go back to sleep by all means. Okay. But if you're lying there and you're still feeling yourself to be excited, that's what I mean by a displacement activity. And those work really well.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
And thank you for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And our next caller is Judy. Judy is in Santa Cruz as well. Hello, Judy.
So glad you're here.
Yeah.
I've been in recovery from an open heart surgery called
Don't be nervous. Don't be nervous.
Anyway,
take a deep breath and tell me what you had again.
PAH. I had a fatal lung disease in 2008.
Pulmonary arterial hypertension.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
And the type that I had, luckily, was redeemable through major surgery, which I had 4.5 years ago. So I've been struggling, and I've been victorious in turning my hours around. So now I'm a day person, so I'm starting to sleep. So the weight's starting to come off.
And great.
I belong to a local gym, so I did a really tough workout for myself, for me, you know, about 2 weeks ago. And then I never recovered, and I got sick, and I realized, oh, my gosh, I did that right during this fire, and so I haven't exercised. That was a week ago last Sunday. I haven't been back down there because I have this bronchial condition that, to tell you the truth, I'm a very experimental. I've done a lot of self-healing, so I'm waiting to get some yerba sante for my lungs because I have found that that helps me even when antibiotics. But I'm wondering, if the fire is still dangerous, if I should even exercise today. I kind of feel like going down there, but I don't think it's healthy to exercise yet. What do you say?
Well, what I would say is that when you have a pulmonary condition of any kind, and this pulmonary condition could include asthma, COPD of any kind, when you have a pulmonary issue of any kind, it's super, super important not to push your lungs. Exercising indoors, if you have a HEPA filter or something like that.
A what?
HEPA, HEPA filter. It's a that might be something to look into to getting. This does is this is something that will clean the indoor air and take the smoke out.
So
you need to get one of those and maybe have an exercise bicycle or something that you could use inside. Those filters are very, very helpful for getting gunk out of the air. So many people with lung conditions simply have to really be careful. Now, let me talk to the audience about this condition. This is a very interesting medical condition. And essentially, it's a spasm in the blood vessels of the lungs. And so the lungs actually develop isolated hypertension. So we all know about high blood pressure, but this is local high blood pressure just in the lungs. And so it interferes when the heart beats. The heart has to push, your whole heart full of blood has to go through the lungs. Half your heart full of blood has to go through the lungs and half has to go through the rest of your body. So if you think in terms of your left ventricle putting out, let's say, 500 cc's of blood in a beat. that's going everywhere, to your brain, to your arms, to your legs. And in the meantime, you've got to fast track, say, 400 cc's through the lungs and have that come back around into the left heart so that 400 to 500 cc's can be pumped, now that it's full of oxygen, be pumped out to the body and fuel the brain and fuel the extremities. Now, when you start exercising, that increases the demand for oxygen. So, and for sugar. So your heart beats faster and harder to supply that demand. But if the lungs can't let that blood flow through, then it backs up. And that's called that's the right-sided heart failure that is common in pulmonary hypertension. And so what they did with you is they basically shunted some of that blood around the lungs in order for you to be able to not back up into your lungs. And so that...
May I interrupt? I believe what they did was they actually... Well, the doctor told me, the surgeon told me, that he removed the blood clots that were in the arteries near my lungs. That were in my lungs near my heart, excuse me. So that's why I was one of the, quote, lucky ones. Most people, their heart just eventually gives out because it becomes inverted in shape, as you're discussing.
Mm-hmm. And the blood clots are probably there because you can't move the blood forward. So you have to watch putting an excessive strain on your heart in the future, because while you've been treated, the factor that led to this problem in the first place may not have been completely eliminated. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You were a setup for this, and
yeah,
they haven't addressed necessarily why you were a setup for it.
Well, I'd like to be your patient if I can afford it.
Well, you can come and see me for a consultation. I just do by-the-hour consultations at the same office over on Mission Street. And then I have a primary care practice that people can join, and you know, not everyone can afford $170 a month, I understand that. But that actually gets you full-service, everything kind of medical care. And, you know, you could go to the website, which is optimagehealth.com, and read the FAQs and decide whether you want to come in for a consultation or whether you want to come in for or whether you want to consider joining.
And not so much.
Either option is open.
That sounds pretty reasonable. You mean that would cover all my visits?
Yes.
Okay, now what is the website again? Because your husband gave me one. I have one already written down.
Okay, so the website for the practice is OptImage Health. But you can just go to AskDrDawn.com, and there's a button that will link you to the practice.
Oh, good. Thank you.
All
great.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the call, and I hope I see you in my office soon.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome.
Great weekend.
Bye-bye. And go straight to our next caller, and that is Mardeen in Ben Lomond. Mardeen, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. Great. I'm getting the hang of this. Okay, shoot. Yes. How can I help you?
Well, I've been following you since KUSP and on your podcast, and I'm really glad that you found a new home there at KSCO.
Thank you. Me too. And thanks to Jackie Tucker for making it possible.
Yeah. Oh, that's really great. So I'm calling because I have been searching for an alternative to traditional insurance for quite some time, and I recently came across a group of companies. I don't know if you call them companies. They're Health Cost Share Ministries. Have you heard of this?
Ministries is making me a little nervous. No, I haven't. I haven't.
Well, basically, there are four that I know of, and three of the four are definitely religion-based, Christian-based, and you know, require that members have to go to a church and have a pastor recommend them and, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one that is more open-minded and available for, you know, Jews and Muslims and anybody who wants to participate. But the concept is the same for all of them. It's basically the members pay a monthly amount into a pool, which is then used to pay for the cost, you know, pay for medical care for the members who need it. So the more people participate, the more money is available, and they don't guarantee that they will pay for everything, but they basically, there's no restriction on what doctor you can see, or what kind of care you want. It can be, you know, acupuncture and massage and, you know, whatever you need.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way up to, you know, $1 million for, you know, major medical care.
Sure. Now, this wouldn't probably qualify for as health insurance under the Obamacare regulations. So
it does.
It does. Okay. That was.
Yes, it does.
So you wouldn't be subject to the penalty.
No, you wouldn't.
It's very interesting. So what I would look, I mean, this is a sort of collective self-insurance scheme.
Sort of.
Yeah, companies can often decide, rather than paying health insurance premiums for their employees, that they're just going to self-insure. And what that means is that they hire an administrator and they pay the bills, and the administrating agency, you know, does the sort of due diligence appropriateness for the visit and pushes the paper around. And that's something that is affordable for large companies that can afford to absorb, say, a cancer diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this sort of insurance is that you really need a large enough number of people, and some of them have to be healthy. So,
right.
You know, which is the trick, because those who are really super healthy not making a lot of money, read young people who are maybe working at a coffee shop that doesn't pay the health insurance, might say, you know, I'll just pay the penalty because my taxable income is so low that, you know, they can only get me for so much. And, you know, that kind of calculus happens. So one of the things you worry about is adverse selection, where in a group like this, everybody's sick and they join. And then before you get to 2/3 of the way through the year, all of the money in the fund has been exhausted. And you may be have signed a contract that means you have to have a buy-in, or that you have to keep paying money even if the fund is exhausted. This thing could go bankrupt, and then whatever you've paid into it would dissolve. So insofar as it has a reserve fund, you know, you should know what that reserve fund is. Also, something like this, if one of the administrators or one of the accountants decides to make off with the cash and go live in the Cayman Islands, you know, you're not going to be, you're just out the door, up the creek, out the door, you know, et cetera, without the proverbial paddle. But if you don't have
definitely more risky.
Yeah, but if you don't have a downside, you know, you might be able to defray your costs. But remember, you've got a cost every month. Can't you qualify for something under the California covered California thing?
Yes, but it would cost my family $1,300 a month, which is more than our mortgage payment. So that just doesn't work for me. Because the coverage is so ridiculously insufficient.
Yeah, it's major medical. It's true. Well, what would your fee be for this outfit? Would it be
about $170 a month?
And that's for more than one person.
I think for a family, it's $250.
Okay. I'm skeptical. I'm afraid that it's not. I'm afraid it might not be able to fund itself in the long run. And
they've been around for more than 10 years, and one of the things that they do to sort of improve the pool is, you know, since most of them are Christian based, they don't accept people who have a history of drug use or you know, things that are anti-health.
Yeah, the main thing I would look at would be the average age of the insured people.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't know if they'll give you that information, but if you've got a large percentage of people, say between 55 and 65, that's the group that tends to be the most expensive. That's why they have the highest premiums.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's got a lot of people in there, and also you want to look at how many women of childbearing age and what they pay for childcare, because one bad baby with neonatal intensive care unit can burn through millions of dollars. And what are you going to do? Let a baby die? Of course not. But but if they've got insurance that's going to be paying for it, that could be a problem.
Yeah.
So those are just some things. Try to get more information. Make sure that you can opt out. I think that's really my best bet, is look at the opt-out clause and make sure that you're not going to be throwing good money after bad.
yeah, like forced to pay for 5 years or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly, which if I were writing something like this, I'd want to lock people in.
Yeah.
Just to make it work. So take a look at the take a fine comb look at the contract, and I would go searching kind of the internet, Yelp and critiques. Look for negative articles and see what
I did that already. Actually, I went to Rip Off Report and I just searched for reviews, and there were no negative reviews I could find.
Well, Mardine, it sounds like you're a smart consumer, and if you decide to take the leap, I'd love to hear about your. I'd love to hear 6 months from now about what your experience has been.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and I will look into it and come back to the audience with more information sometime in the next few months.
Would I have time for one more quick question?
Real quick.
Okay. A couple of weeks ago, I had my first experience with what I'm pretty sure was acid reflux. And I went to the emergency care because I was concerned I might be having a heart attack. And, you know, they did an EKG, everything, all my vitals looked normal, no problems. But, you know, the symptoms were very much like what I've heard, acid reflux. And since then, I have had no symptoms. So I'm kind of wondering, is this something that I really have to, you know, start changing my lifestyle and eating habits and everything to avoid happening again? Or is it something that could just happen once and not happen again?
Absolutely. I mean, the average person has one or two episodes of acid reflux a day. They just don't notice them.
Huh.
And the severe ones are the ones you notice, and you had a severe.
Yeah.
So the question I always ask is, okay, is it isolated or is it starting to be a trend? And if you have one and then you go a week and you don't have another, it was isolated. If you have one and then 3 days later you have another and then the day after that you have another, then you're getting into one of those loops I love to talk about where the acid is actually interfering with the seal. And then once you lose your seal, you're like walking around with a full glass of water and you're spilling acid up into your esophagus, which makes it swell, which keeps the esophageal sphincter open. So now you continually spill. And so it'll amplify and loop and get more and more common and more frequent. And that's when you pull out the drugs. Basically, for something like this, half a teaspoon of bicarbonate in a glass of water if you don't have hypertension, widely available, very fast-acting, Maalox, Mylanta, antacids in general, reasonably effective, it takes a little more time. But if it starts being a trend and you're needing to chew up the Tums every day, then at that point you're in a loop, and there is a very helpful reflux handout on my website at AskDrDawn.com. Go to the resources section. It's right near the top. And that's kind of the first level of intervention. How do you avoid looping if you're getting more frequent reflux episodes? And then if that's not working, then you go to the drugs.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, thank you. Very helpful.
Thank you. You have a great day.
All right.
Bye-bye.
You too.
And I'm so happy. We've got lots of callers, and we're going now to Tate in Felton with long QT syndrome. Hello, Tate.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. So
good.
How did you find out you have long QT syndrome?
Well, I actually found out. I have a brother that's in his 20s now, but when he was a teen, almost passed from it.
Yes, it can be very, very
because,
dangerous.
Yeah, both. It ends up, it ends up being that both of his parents, luckily it's not both of my parents, but both of his parents have it, which is very, very rare. And so about 2 years ago, my daughter's mother was putting my daughter onto ADHD drugs, and I was very against it. So I fought in court and had the daughter taken and tested, and you know, it prolonged it, but luckily she doesn't have it. But in getting tested, and we had the whole family tested, I was tested, and I was one of the ones that came up with it.
Right. A simple EKG will tell you what's going on with that. And there are a lot of drugs that we might ordinarily take so that could aggravate this. So let me take a moment and talk a little bit for the audience about what this actually is. Now, our heart, when it beats, the atrium beats, and that's the first wave, and that's called a P wave. It's a little blip, and then the wave propagates electrically to the ventricle, and then the ventricle beats, and we get this big zigzaggy thing called the QRS segment, and that's the EKG that we all know and love and see printed on T-shirts and, you know, see it on TV all the time, and it goes flatline, and there's that sound. So that's the QRS. And then there's a reboot called the T, and this is the repolarization. So you can think of it as the heart beats like we kicked a spring open. We kicked a spring, and the spring released, and that sent the blood through the body. But now we have to ratchet that spring back down again in order to have another release, like a jack in the box, right? You got to punch it back down, and that release is the T. Now, under ordinary circumstances, the T happens late enough that it does that the QRS and the T are separated in time, but if you have long QT syndrome, what can happen is that the T gets stepped on by the P. And so you end up with the heart trying to repolarize and depolarize at the same time, and it throws you into ventricular fibrillation, which means suddenly you're not moving any blood at all. If you have a slightly long QT, it's not a big deal. If you have a long QT and you take a drug that prolongs it further, then the pacemaker in the atria could accidentally kick the heart into this fibrillation state, and that's a sudden death event, potentially. Or if they get the paddles out and shock your heart back, you're good.
Yeah, my brother actually has an installed defibrillator.
Yeah, he might have to. And we're talking things, over-the-counter things, like some of the antihistamines, some of the weight loss drugs, certainly almost all of the drugs for ADD, certain antibiotics, Z-Pak, azithromycin, a common one. So it wouldn't surprise you that cocaine would do it, but it might surprise you that an antibiotic would do it, or a drug like Elavil, which is an old antidepressant that a lot of people use for sleep. So knowing that you have long QT is really important, particularly if you're going to go under anesthesia. And there are workarounds for every single thing that would worsen long QT syndrome. There is a substitute thing that can be used. So it's just really important, number one, not to combine agents, because most people won't get atrial fib from taking one of these drugs. It's a rare event, but it just makes that rare event that much less rare. And if you're taking two or three of these drugs, well, then you're starting to buy too many lottery tickets in the bad lottery.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I guess my main question is that, see, I also deal with severe anxiety and depression. And so I'm on quite a few drugs, but I know that they're not on the list. I've been pretty aware of the list of drugs I'm not supposed to take, but I've been, for about the last year and a half, I've been homebound.
Is this because of your depression?
Because of the depression, well, mostly the anxiety, and then it leads to that depression, yeah.
Okay. So what's your question?
So I guess my question is just, I guess I don't know how to exercise at all without, for long Q, or long QT, sorry. So it's like more of like an exercise question, because I'm not in shape at all anymore.
Well, you could, basically you want to exercise in a monitored situation initially. And so there's cardiac rehab. They can hook you up to a treadmill to regular exercise it and keep you on a monitor. And what you try to do with that monitor is find that phase space for safe exercise. And you absolutely should be exercising, but it's more like starting with walking or strolling or something like that. And being in a monitored situation where they've got the paddles, and worst case scenario, something happens, they just bring you right back. And that's how they do it. And then once you've explored the safe zone, then you start exercising within the safe zone. And the safe zone is, exercise is really important for treating depression. Also, I would say get a vitamin D level. Make sure your vitamin D level is at least 50. because that can help with depression. And if you're indoors all the time,
okay.
I bet your vitamin D level is really, really low. And that
I try to go out and sit for like 5-10 minutes, but it's just, it doesn't feel like enough. So
no, you probably have a low level. You might be able to get there with supplements, and that would be, you know, a really low-hanging fruit first step, walking, and so get your vitamin D level up to about 50, and that won't affect your QT. Both of those would be really safe.
All right. Yeah, it's just a fear thing with it, I guess.
I know, but you can't let your fear paralyze you. And that's where that's where the cardiac rehab folks are great, because you're in a guarded, safe situation. They've got your back, and that'll give you the courage and the confidence you need.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Dawn.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you for the call.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. So this has been a really wonderful hour. I want to thank everyone who called in, and of course I want to thank the people who emailed. Again, you can email by going to askdrdawn.com, and maybe you'll make it on to next month's show. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Bansky. Music by John Scoville.